Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 8, 2013, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome once again to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleform conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing McCutcheon v. FEC, the campaign finance case argued earlier today in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note, as always, that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call the chairman of the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, Mr. Eric Jaffe. Mr. Jaffe is in private practice here in Washington, D.C., where he specializes in appellate litigation, concentrating on constitutional issues. He attended argument this morning in McCutcheon v. FEC and is going to give us his account of what transpired after giving us some background on the case, and then he'll take questions from the audience. And with that, Mr. Jaffe, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you, of course, to the Federalist Society for having me. So in today's argument in McCutcheon, the issue the court was considering was whether the so-called aggregate limits on contributions to candidates and political parties or political committees was constitutional. So as most of you, or hopefully all of you know, there are limits on how much you can contribute to any individual candidate. $2,600, I think it is, over the course of a two-year election cycle. There are also limits on how much you can give to a political party or a political committee, which would be something like the RNC or the DNC, the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, things like that, that their sole purpose is to transfer money over to candidates and to support their candidates in elections. And those limits are somewhat higher. I think you can give $5,000 to certain types of committees. You can give, I think, 20-something thousand to committees collectively. But in any event, there is a macro limit sitting on top of all of that that says you can't contribute, whether to a candidate or to a party, more than a certain amount of money each year. I believe it's in the 70-something thousand dollar range. And the practical effect of that is it limits the number of contributions you can make. So if you wanted to make the maximum contribution, you could only make it to a limited number of candidates before you ran up against the limit. So even if there were other candidates out there that you had given no money to, and so you could still give something within the individual limit to that candidate, if you've already given to 10 or 15 candidates and hit your max, you can no longer give to those other candidates even though you've given them nothing. And the basic argument of the petitioners, the individual petitioner and the RNC, was that, look, if these individual contributions are not, if these limited individual contributions are not corrupting, well, then giving it to 30 different people versus giving them to 10 different people, that makes no difference. You're not corrupting the next 20 because you're giving them a relatively modest amount, and hence the fact that you've given to their neighbor and somebody 10 states over is not going to corrupt any of the earlier guys in any meaningful way. And the RNC's view is similar, that, you know, giving to the party a certain amount, as long as that's within the limit, is not going to corrupt the party, it's not going to corrupt the candidates, just because you also give modest amounts to other folks that collectively would be above the aggregate limit. When these limits were first passed, pre-Buckley, the theory for an aggregate limit was largely based on a circumvention rationale, is that if I could give if I could give unlimited numbers of contributions to different organizations and to different committees, well, then you could have 50 different committees. I'm going to give the limit to each one of them, but they're all going to turn around and give it to a single candidate, which they were allowed to do. And so that would mean effectively I had given, 10 or 50 or 100 times the limit to one person simply by dividing my money up among a bunch of different committees who then turned around and transferred it to the candidate. So in terms of that type of circumvention mechanism, this aggregate limit was basically a means of saying, look, the total you can give across all these different committees is fixed, so that even if you're going to circumvent it, it won't be that big a circumvention because you can't give that big a total. Over the years, and particularly in BCRA, a number of things have been adopted that sort of mitigate that sort of back end transferring the money through intermediaries to a candidate kind of circumvention. There's anti-earmarking provisions, so I can't give it to a committee and say, you should give this to John Doe. There are anti-proliferation provisions, which stop multiple committees being set up by a single person who would control them all and hence be in a position to redirect the money they receive to a single candidate and be corrupting that way. There are a number of different things of that sort that sort of help mitigate that circumvention risk. The other reason that wasn't quite as prominent back in the Buckley period, but has become more prominent in the arguments these days, is that you're, even if you're not corrupting a single candidate by redirecting large amounts to that person in small bites, what you are doing is you're sort of giving a large aggregate amount of money to the team. And giving money to the team will corrupt all the members of that team because they're grateful that you're helping the team. So if I give, you know, 10 contributions to 10 Republican candidates, obviously they're reasonably happy with me, but, you know, they're modest contributions. But if I give the maximum contribution to every single candidate and to every single party committee that exists, that totals up to a pretty big number, about $3.5 million, $3.6 million, if you gave the maximum to everyone you could possibly give it to. And that, the argument goes, is corrupting in the same way that soft money is corrupting, in that all the members of the party understand that you're a multi-million-dollar donor, and even though no individual got a huge chunk of that money, collectively the party benefited. It helped them perhaps maintain a majority or gain a majority in one of the houses. It helped them do all kinds of things that obviously they would view as a benefit. The second piece of that puzzle is that you can also have these things called joint fundraising committees where somebody solicits contributions for multiple candidates, and that the person doing the soliciting, let's say it's the Speaker of the House or something like that, you sort of give their committee a bunch of money to be redistributed in small chunks, in lawful small chunks, to other folks. But the person who was the aggregator basically would, you know, be very indebted to you for you know, helping the party out, helping the majority out or the minority out, and for making them a power broker basically, the person who sort of got that collective contribution together. So that's where the sort of the ground stands on what the arguments are in favor of these aggregate limits and why they exist. The arguments against them are a couple-fold. The petitioner, in this case, the individual petitioner, McCutcheon, his counsel primarily focused on the anti-circumvention arguments, pointing out why they're not realistically a problem anymore, and that new laws and new FEC rules stop that problem in other ways, and that while there are some somewhat convoluted hypotheticals where you could still beat the circumvention rules, those are pretty far-fetched, and there seems to be no evidence that really happens. The Republican National Committee, which also had some argument time today, tended to focus more, as you would expect them to, on the shift of money away from parties and towards PACs, and argued that this weakens the parties. It strengthens these sort of PACs that are very often sort of single-issue groups or extremist groups or whatever you want to call them, but groups that are obviously outside the control of the party. And to some extent, they think it also tends to act as an incumbent protection scheme. So while PACs tend to be focused on issues, parties tend to focus on attacking their opponents' weak incumbents. Party money tends to be directed towards races where your opponent's incumbent is weak and you think you can unseat them. And so the argument went that the, you know, party money tends, if you squelch down on party money, what you're effectively doing is protecting incumbents from each party from attacks by the opposing party, which is presumably why Congress actually went along with this, is because it sort of butters their own bread by making it harder for challengers to get party support, to get meaningful direct party support in terms of cash. There was also, the RNC also pointed out, I think interestingly, that when you have limits on how many people big donors can give to, that, you know, if the person who's capable of giving the maximum can only give to a limited number of candidates before hitting the aggregate maximum, well then the candidates and the party committees all have to compete with each other to be one of the select group that actually gets money from that big donor. And that sort of causes competition rather than cooperation within the party. And that, of course, is something the national parties would presumably not like very well. Encountering this, Solicitor General Verrilli made a very weak defense of the anti-circumvention arguments. He sort of wouldn't give it up, but he didn't do much to defend it in any credible way, and instead focused primarily on this notion of large aggregate giving still creates a sense of indebtedness, and it was his phrase of, you know, you're helping the team, and he analogized it to soft money giving, where you gave tons of money to the party, even though it wasn't to any individual candidate, obviously the party itself and the party leadership, and hence ultimately the representatives and senators would be grateful that you helped the team, and that's really where he focused his energy. So some of the big results in terms of the argument, in terms of how the justices were reacting, I think the first is that the circumvention point didn't really gain a lot of traction. And there was some support for the notion that to the extent that there are some lingering minor avenues of circumvention, or less plausible avenues of circumvention, there are at least less restrictive means of dealing with those. So Justice Scalia, for example, was highly skeptical that there would be much circumvention at all, and sort of thought the existing anti-earmarking rules probably took care of most of them. The Chief Justice and Justice Alito both thought, both suggested through their questioning at least, that there are other ways to solve the few situations where you might circumvent it. For example, an anti-transfer rule, where different committees can't just transfer money around among themselves into candidates. So if you circumvented this by giving tons of money to a committee or by giving money to a bunch of different candidates with a wink and a nod that those candidates would all transfer it to the guy who faces the toughest race, you could have an anti-transfer rule that stopped different candidates from transferring money to other candidates, and that would easily solve this kind of problem without an aggregate limit. Elena Kagan, Justice Kagan, and Justice Breyer were really the only ones to sort of bite on the notion that circumvention was a problem. But, you know, sort of as they went through their hypotheticals, they seemed more and more convoluted and more tenuous. So while I think they would certainly merrily go along with saying it still serves a circumvention role, there didn't seem to be many others biting on that too much. Justice Kennedy, of course, is in the middle on this all, asked a brief question on this, but it was an ambiguous question, and really you can read much from it. The second big issue, sort of along with what I was saying before, is this giving it to the team soft money analogy. And Justice Kagan was the lead proponent of that, along with, of course, Solicitor General Verrilli. She was the lead person sort of thinking that there would be a lot of gratitude among the members of any given party if a large donor gave a large aggregate amount, even if it was just in bite-sized pieces, to all of the different party candidates. Again, this is the soft money analogy. You're helping other members of my party so that we can maintain a majority, so that we can get things we want passed, so that the leadership is happy, and that at the end of the day is the quid that you'd be giving for the eventual pro quo, the quo that would, you know, the leadership would then be more likely to do what you want, or to pass legislation you liked, or to at least take your phone call. Justice Sotomayor, I thought, was biting on this one a little bit, but it wasn't really the focus of her argument. It was Kagan who mostly went there, and so we'll see. I mean, I think if this comes out in favor of the FEC, it will be on this theory and not on the circumvention theory. The answer to this, the other side of this coin, is the third big point that I thought was interesting about the argument, is that there was an extended back and forth regarding the difference between giving to parties and candidates and giving to PACs. So Justice Scalia was the lead proponent of this, pointing out that, look, what the effect of an aggregate rule that says you can't give a lot of money, collectively give a lot of money to candidates and parties, is that you just give them to PACs. Now, you know, independent spending PACs that just go out and say vote for candidate X anyway, but they just do it independently without consultation. And Scalia thought that PACs are worse, right? That taking the money out of the parties and putting them into the hands of PACs, who you can give millions of dollars to rather than just these thousands that we're talking about, that is far worse in the sense of someone being grateful. If somebody spent $40 million on independent spending that said elect President Obama, presumably Obama's more grateful to that than the guy who gave a few million dollars to a bunch of different candidates. Scalia's, the implications Scalia draws from that are twofold. First, the first implication he drew from that was that, look, we said PACs are constitutional and they're worse than this, so this must be constitutional also. The harm can't be that bad since we said the harm in the PAC context is not that bad, so where's the harm? And then the second implication he drew from that was that it's bad to hurt the parties, that at the end of the day, the parties, giving to the parties is a better idea since it helps with compromise, it helps sort of get control within the establishment of the system rather than toss control out to the extremists who are motivated enough to form a pack and beat the drum. But I thought his arguments had sort of a double-edged sword to them. Rather than saying PACs are okay, he spent a lot of time saying PACs are terrible. And if they're terrible, what, we let them go on, so we might as well let this go too. How bad can it be? Well, that's an argument for why PACs are terrible. I'm not sure it's an argument why this is okay. If you think this is bad and PACs are worse, the implications are maybe that you should not let so much PAC spending go on. Justice Kennedy, this is one of the few things he sort of chimed in on again, and he sort of agreed that, you know, the large-scale PAC spending might arguably be worse in terms of any gratitude some candidate or party would have, but he wasn't clear on what he thought the implication of that was. Justice Kagan gave the most interesting implication of this, which he said, well, if that's really what you think, then that just shows why our current PAC jurisprudence is wrong, basically inviting an overrule of Citizens United. I don't think that's going to happen, but it was certainly one of the possible implications of this line of arguments in terms of the parties versus the PACs. At the end of the day, I would think that the folks on the right are more likely to think, well, if PACs don't create corruption, despite the fact that obviously there's a lot of potential gratitude towards an effective PAC, well, then the potential gratitude toward distributed giving, even if it's large in the aggregate, is not such a big constitutional concern that you would squelch free speech. Hopefully that's the way it will cut, but who knows? This was, again, a double-edged sword. The fourth sort of interesting set of points from the argument were the sort of potential compromise results that I thought were being floated by different justices. So one compromise result was sort of having less restrictive anti-transfer rules being okay. And I suppose and that was being floated by the Chief Justice and by Justice Alito and a little bit by Justice Scalia, where, you know, there are other less restrictive means of dealing with the circumvention problem by stopping transfers between candidates, for example. The implication of that in terms of the result of this case might well be that they strike the current rules down, but effectively invite Congress to pass a slightly less restrictive version of the rules that would still address this aggregate giving problem in terms of creating gratitude and giving to the team, but perhaps allow some broader contributions to candidates within a different framework of some sort. A second compromise, a pseudo-compromise that was being floated from the other side was the notion that the record in this case is not good enough to tell on some of these issues that are very fact-bound, you know, the notion of how much gratitude is there for giving to the team, what's the real risk of circumvention. And this was being floated primarily by Justice Breyer and a little bit by Justice Sotomayor, which would effectively be a remand for better records. This case came up, I believe, on a motion for injunction, but it was basically treated like a motion to dismiss, and neither party sought a record or an evidentiary hearing. They both sort of agreed that it was a legal question. But I think Breyer correctly recognizes that if you toss this back for fact-finding, the government will just lard up the record in a way that will make it easier for Breyer to get to the result he wants, which is to uphold this rule. And I think that would probably be the result if it gets tossed back for a remand. In general, few other people seem to be biting on this notion. Justice Scalia sort of was openly opposed to the notion that you needed a further record for this legal question. And even Justice Ginsburg was a little skeptical about the need for a further record, given that both parties agreed below that there was no need for fact-finding. So just the proceduralist in her might balk at that kind of result. But those are the sort of the two potential compromises. I don't realistically see the remand happening. The sort of the notion of less restrictive alternatives being the basis for a decision and then, you know, kicking it back to Congress to pass a slightly different rule, I could see that being something orchestrated by the chief and by Justice Alito. The final group of sort of interesting points from argument were sort of some quirky views expressed by different justices. The first one is sort of Justice Breyer's sort of quirky view that the whole point of these kinds of rules is to equalize speech for the small guy. So his notion was you have a number of big spenders who could theoretically give the maximum to everybody in the race, and if you let these guys spend a lot of money in contributions, then the folks who can only give a few contributions will feel left out, will feel swamped and insignificant, and that will demotivate them. This, of course, is sort of Bilotti's speech equalization theory dressed up in new clothes. The current garb that Breyer is trying to lay over this argument is that it would disillusion people and get them uninterested in politics, sort of demotivate them from participating in politics at all, because it's sort of an appearance of corruption. But at the end of the day, all it is speech equalization, that we think rich people get to speak too much. And it's just peculiar that he continues to hold this view, given the long, long history of rejecting this principle. Maybe it's not so peculiar, but it's sort of disheartening, I suppose, that he, to this day, refuses to buy into the notion that equalizing the speech of different folks is not a valid interest. A second point, sort of along similar lines, was made by Justice Ginsburg, where she sort of asked, well, how many people does this really affect? We're only stopping a few of the ultra-rich from making these contributions, and most contributors can't contribute up to the aggregate limit anyway, so who cares? Once again, that's sort of one of the, oh, so who cares if we squash the rich? They don't really deserve to be speaking anyway kind of approach. Again, somewhat disheartening, but perhaps not surprising. And then the last quirky view is one I already mentioned, was Justice Kagan's sort of suggestion in response to this party versus PAC discussion that, well, maybe then Citizens United is wrong, which I think, if I recall correctly, was echoed a little bit by Justice Breyer, in the sense of they haven't sort of given up hope on overruling Citizens United. And I think what is most interesting about that is it tells you if they get one more vote, they will. So that while that is case law of the moment, it is not precedent that anybody has any real interest in respecting to the extent that they get the votes to go the other way. So that's the summary. I mean, I think it's just to give sort of a rundown of where I think folks might vote or where they stand, I think it's reasonably safe to count Justice Kagan and Justice Ginsburg as on the side of upholding the aggregate limits. It's probably pretty safe to count Justice Scalia on the side of striking them down, and let's put Justice Thomas in there just for fun, because in his past votes he's certainly shown a pretty deep antipathy to a lot of the campaign finance stuff. Justices Breyer and Sotomayor, I think, would be happy with a compromise result on remand, but if that's not in the cards, I imagine would vote to uphold the current rules. Justice Breyer would even do so on the circumvention grounds, which I think is the weakest of all the grounds. On a less restrictive alternative theory, I think you have the Chief and Justice Alito, which I think leads to the result of striking these down, but perhaps an opinion that leaves open the door for meaningfully further regulation, even if it's not quite this regulation. But they might, for example, recognize the validity of the, you know, you're giving to the team theory of corruption. And that could be a mixed bag. It would lead to a temporary win here, but it might strengthen a theory that is ultimately a very large theory that you might not want to strengthen. And Justice Kennedy, it's just really hard to tell. He didn't speak much. His questions, the few questions he asked, were both somewhat ambiguous. And he seemed to be taking the position of, you know, getting counsel to answer questions from both the left and the right, trying to find sort of some middle ground. So if there's going to be a compromise, I imagine it will be driven by him. And I suppose the one that I most plausibly see is this less restrictive alternative approach, perhaps sort of giving his vote over to the Chief Justice, but sort of forcing an opinion that still leaves open the door for considerable regulation of aggregate contributions in some other way. So that's all in terms of the recap of the argument and the things that I found most interesting about it. I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you. If you've joined us late, we're speaking with Eric Jaffe talking about the
McCutcheon versus FEC case that was argued in the court this morning. We normally try to send out reminders as these telephone conference calls begin, but I've been alerted to the fact that today's reminder hit some few minutes late. So I think, Eric, several of the people on the call, we've got quite a few, probably missed at least the earlier parts of your opening remarks. So let me just say that we'll turn now to questions from the audience. All questions are fair game. You don't have to be worried that your question might have been addressed in the earlier parts of Eric Jaffe's remarks. So
sure, yeah, please, no worries at all. Any kind of questions, even if it's something I covered before, I'm happy to cover it again or explain it differently.
Terrific. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Eric Jaffe, all topics are on the table. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And let me announce while we're waiting, we have a call scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be focusing on a Seventh Circuit gun case that's being argued by David Thompson of Cooper and Kirk, who's going to talk about that case, about the argument, and take your questions as well. Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be joined by Clark Neely and Eileen O'Connor. Clark Neely will be featured in talking about his new book, Terms of Engagement, How Our Courts Should Enforce the Constitution's Promise of Limited Government. But today, let's turn to Eric Jaffe and our audience with questions. So let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Was there any sign in any of this of arguments concerning the points that, first of all, corruption, quote-unquote, is void for vagueness, that there is actually no authority in the Constitution to make bribery a crime or even to legislate against it, except for the provisions that allow houses of Congress to regulate the their own members, in which case the authority of Congress in this field would be limited to incumbent members and not to non-incumbent challengers.
No, there was no sign at all of that. I think that argument is so far off the table from where they're at that no one even suggested it. I think everyone takes as a given at this point that at up to a certain level, Buckley was right and acceptable, that the notion of corruption is something within Congress's bailiwick. There were a few examples, for instance, of the notion of giving someone a car, so not even a campaign contribution, just a car. And every member of the court to comment on that example, even Justice Scalia, for example, readily conceded that that's corrupt and that's a bribe and that's okay to regulate. And the real question was, how is this different from that? And the most obvious way it's different is that you can't put campaign contributions to personal use, and so it's different. In my mind, of course, that means that they're not corrupt at all, but that's certainly not where the court's at. I think the court, at the moment at least, accepts the very basic ruling in Buckley that a massive direct contribution to an individual candidate or incumbent would, even if it's just useful for campaign purposes, would be corrupting. And no one has even remotely suggested that they're challenging that at this point.
Once again, if you have a question for Eric Jaffe, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like we have one more question pending, then our lines will be completely open, so feel free to ring in. Push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, this is Joe Crosby in D.C., Eric. Two questions. One of them is that SCOTUS blog, in previewing this case, talked a lot about the standard and said something about that Buckley had to do, talked about contribution limits in terms of the right to assemble and expenditure limits in terms of the right to free speech. It sounds as though this was entirely about free speech, and that issue didn't come up at all. I'm wondering about that. And the second thing that strikes me as kind of peculiar is that a lot of business people I know are happy to have a campaign contribution limit because it means that they won't get hit up by the politicians. And the argument, it sounds like, in the Supreme Court was all about the power that business people or rich people might have over politicians, did the question about the kind of reciprocal power that politicians might have over over richer people to be able to ask for a larger contribution come up at all?
So going backwards, the second one didn't come up at all, though I agree. I've heard certainly anecdotally from executives and folks with the money to give that they're actually quite content to not be on the hook from politicians who drum them for contributions. But no, that didn't come up. It didn't come up on, certainly, I mean, the only people who would raise that presumably would be the government, and that was not at all the theme of their point. And my recollection was you didn't even see that in their briefs, that this is mostly about whether or not parties and politicians would feel indebted to the ultra-rich. So that wasn't really an issue, though I agree it's a sort of an interesting twist that you don't hear a whole lot about, I suppose, because it would be unflattering, grossly unflattering for senators to admit that they basically strong-arm contributions out of people. On the first question of what the standard is, that the standard, any potential difference in standard between expenditures versus direct speech and where this would lie in that spectrum, you know, there was very, very little and only oblique reference to it. There was a brief question by Justice Roberts that sort of recognized the burden that this would place on sort of the modestly well-off. So folks who wanted to give to 10 instead of 9 or 8 or 7 candidates and couldn't do it. Not the folks that could give to everyone and spend $3.5 million, but the guy who's going to spend $100,000 or $150,000 giving to a slate of candidates that agree with them on some issues, let's say a small government candidates or Tea Party candidates or what have you, but isn't really in a position to influence the entire body. And Justice Roberts, after noting that there was a meaningful First Amendment burden on those kinds of folks who could only give to 5 instead of to 10 or whatever it was, so asked the question, so what standard do you apply? What do you do with that admitted burden? How do you measure that burden, and what do you need to overcome that burden? And never really got an answer. So while it seemed for a brief moment that he was going there, it never took off, and none of the other justices even sort of approached it. So if I had to guess, this is going to be treated like contribution limits, and according to the sort of less strict standard of it needs to be important rather than true strict scrutiny. There was a brief and slight mention of it in one of the in the first advocate's arguments, where they said, while we think it ought to be strict scrutiny, we think we win under important purpose test, and then went on to talk about the sort of the good old-fashioned approach to contributions. So if I had to guess, this is going to get resolved based on the standard contribution analysis and not based on some newly decided application of strict scrutiny. True strict scrutiny.
Once again, we're in the question and answer portion of our call. If you have a question for Eric Jaffe, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. And while we're waiting to see if there's another caller question, let me ask Eric. In much of the preview material I've seen about this case, the press is apt to compare this case to Citizens United. I wonder if you want to comment on that. My sense is that the court could strike down the restrictions here, be completely consistent, but still sort of within the confines of Citizens United, that these rules might be a natural subset of what got stricken in Citizens United. Is that the case, or is it more complex than that? Is this going to be another Citizens United moment, quote unquote, even if Citizens United wasn't a Citizens United moment?
Yeah, you know, the way Citizens United played out here, I think, is in this notion that, well, heck, we can already give as much money as we want to independent spending PACs. So what's the harm? Relatively speaking, this is a drop in the bucket. We've already opened the floodgates. And so it sort of has that moment, but by the same token, therefore, it's meaningfully less significant. And the notion that you can spend as much as you want on independent political speech and independent advocacy, I think is far more significant, both from a First Amendment perspective and, quite frankly, from the perspective of those who decry the influence of money, than any of this stuff here is, because the handful of people that are actually going to, you know, give the 2,000 and change or whatever it is to every single candidate and to the committees, as if that mattered when they're going to turn around and give $20 million to the, you know, George Soros PAC that advocates for these candidates just without coordination. It really is sort of the flea on the tail of the dog. And I think that's the point that both sides were making, though, with different implications from them. The reality is, it's meaningful for some folks, but it's just not that meaningful in the larger political scheme of things, is my take on it, is that it's just small potatoes. I'm sure there are a number of folks that it would help, but it's not quite as big. It's not going to have any really meaningful effect on elections in the way that large PAC spending would perhaps have. And I think that effect is good. I think, you know, more speech, more voices out there, and lots of advocacy is something that's a good effect on elections. We should get as much speech out there as possible, but this is, I think, small potatoes by comparison. And given that my general intuition at the moment is that there may be sort of these limits may get struck down, but struck down in sort of a weakish way that allows for them to come back in another form, you know, on sort of a less restrictive alternative analysis, means that it'll open the door for a few instances of things, but it'll close the door on others, and so it won't have that big an effect. It's not going to serve as a major sea change in the law. I think Citizens United was a meaningful and important change in the way we view independent advocacy. I think it was a positive change, the notion that, you know, spending on speech is speech. But I don't think you're going to see that here. It'd be one thing if they had sort of taken the bait on the strict versus not strict scrutiny. Then it could be a much more significant result as you sort of start breaking down the barrier between independent spending and contributions. But I just don't see that's going to happen here. So it's not going to be either an actual Citizens United or what was Citizens United was perceived to be. I think it will end up being something much smaller, which is, of course, not to say that folks won't scream and yell one way or the other, but at the end of the day.
So if the rules are stricken, we can still expect a hue and cry?
I don't think there's any doubt that we'll get a hue and cry. Quite frankly, there'll be a hue and cry whichever way it goes, whether it's from the parties and sort of the free speech folks talking about how terrible this is, or whether it's from the folks who talk about now this means tons of money is going to run into the system, as if there weren't, you know, million times more money in the system already. Scalia, I think, asked the interesting question from Doug Verrilli, you know, so how much money is already being spent by the parties? How much is being spent by the PACs? And the answer is the parties, the various party committees collectively, spend about $1.5 billion each. And this aggregate limit that we're quibbling about, even if you sort of open the gates, there's just not that many people that could take advantage of that. And so it's not clear what impact it would have. I mean, I suppose you could get 500 people giving an aggregate of $3.5 million, and that adds up quite a bit and quite quickly. But at the end of the day, I think it's the smaller effect. And so it's just not going to be that big a deal.
Once again, we're talking to Eric Jaffe. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question pending, and then our lines are completely open, so stand by for the next question.
Hello, this is Lee McGrath calling from Minnesota. I was curious, Mr. Jaffe, if you would comment on whether there was any argument about what really is the perception of corruption. Is it anything more than $2,300, or did any of the lawyers discuss it today?
No, not really. Justice Breyer, you know, sort of came up with his unsupported arguments about why the little guy will feel left out if you allow the big guys to spend more money. But this was just Justice Breyer's sort of theorizing and beating a drum that he's beaten in the past, again, this sort of speech equalization approach. But there was no record evidence on this, certainly. There was no discussion of that kind of evidence. There was a brief passing mention about whether or not the current aggregate limits are really the correct the correct limits to, excuse me, to deal with the perception of corruption. So, you know, the inevitable question, well, if I can give to 9 candidates at the maximum amount, why can't I give to the 10th? That can't possibly be deemed corrupting, right? So there's a line-drawing problem that would happen no matter where you drew the line. But at the end of the day, the SG's answer to that was simply the other side's not seeking to move the line. They're seeking to get rid of the line entirely. And he's right. So neither side was sort of interested in having the fine-tuning discussion. I think sensibly so, given that once you admit that a line is plausible, the fine-tuning, you know, at the end of the day, the court's going to defer to Congress. Congress will make a bunch of findings. They're not going to really challenge them. It's going to be a little charade as to where you draw the line, because everyone knows that no matter where you draw it, half an inch over the line is obviously no different than half an inch under the line. So you didn't see any discussion of that at all. There was no true discussion. What there was discussion of was whether gratitude, this notion of gratitude, counts as corruption. So there was discussion, obviously, if somebody spends $10 million on a PAC that runs an ad that says, elect Democrats because they're good for us, the Democratic Party is going to be really grateful for that, $10 million worth of grateful. Whereas if somebody gives $2 million to the party directly, yeah, they're going to be grateful for that too, but they're going to be $2 million worth of grateful, not $10 million worth of grateful. So there was this notion of is gratitude in general enough to count as corruption, as the quid in a perceived quid pro quo? And Scalia, of course, was taking the position that, you know, in Citizens United, we said that sort of abstract gratitude for helping us out in general is not corruption. And so why would this be corruption, too, if the party is just generally pleased with you for helping them out? It's not like you made a deal. It's not like there was a contingency. And it's not like you helped one person as opposed to sort of a diffuse set of people. So the discussion of corruption focused on whether corruption is broad enough to encompass gratitude for helping the team versus gratitude for helping the team, but in a more indirect, independent spending kind of way. And it didn't have any satisfactory resolution, I think, basically because the folks on the left think any kind of gratitude is corrupting, whether it's from independent spending or direct contributions. The folks on the right may think large individual contributions could be corrupting, but are a little sketchier on what they think about sort of helping the team by helping the party. And I think in general, they would probably think it's okay to help the party. And they're sort of holding the line on the notion that independent spending is not corrupt, even if it potentially creates some level of gratitude. Now, I think the reality here is that there's a dilemma. As a factual matter, I think the critics are right that independent spending of a high enough magnitude clearly creates gratitude. You know, any candidate and party that knows that George Soros is dropping millions of dollars to help their side get elected and win the House and win the presidency and win this and win that, is going to be responsive to him when he comes knocking at the door for some legislation. To deny that as a factual matter, I think, is absurd. On the other hand, to call it corruption is where the real leap is. Do you think it's corrupt to want to be supportive of your supporters? I mean, presumably they support you as a way of influencing your policy decisions, just like they vote for you as a way of influencing your policy decisions. And we sort of think that it's actually Congress's job to provide constituent service, and they got elected to do X, so they should do X. Well, but that's a quid pro quo and gratitude for election in no different a way than it is with the speech. The difference, the only real difference there being that it's one person, one vote, as opposed to rich people get to spend more. And that's the nub of the fight, is whether we think that money should be treated the way we treat votes, so sort of a one person, one vote, one person, one quanta of speech analysis. That's clearly where the left wants to go. I think it's something that the right is correctly resisting. And I think the analogy doesn't really work, but that's where the fight is, and that's sort of the fight about what is and what is not corrupting.
All right, we've got another question pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Eric. Joe Crosby once again, because you said something a few minutes ago that I thought was very interesting, that I think it's the old First Amendment theory that the more speech, the better. So why should PACs be really all that bad? Because they just add more variety to the speech. But it strikes me that that seems to be directly opposite of what you were saying the Republican Party wanted in their argument, that their concern is that it's all these other guys who are getting in, and the party starts to get drowned out.
Well, let me be clear. I'm not a fan of parties.
Right.
I'm not a fan of parties at all. I think they're greedy little groups that want to control the whole process.
Well, it strikes me, though, that it's also that part of this is the question about who gets to control the dialogue and how much control mm-hmm. there is. It seems to me that politicians in general want to have control over the dialogue, you know, on their election. And the thing that scares them the most is that somebody else that they don't have any control over might actually grab control of it.
I think that's exactly right, which is why you see this quirky dilemma in terms of the party structures and in terms of Congress. You know, on the one side, there's this concern that when you just have the two parties competing against each other, they attack each other's incumbent, you know, weak incumbents, and so obviously the incumbents want to stop that from happening, and so part of the political establishment wants parties not to be so active in screwing the other side over. But the other half of it is, you're right, that they get more pissed about outside speech than they do about speech that at least is sort of within the gentleman's club of, okay, we're going to attack folks, but not too bad, and maybe we won't attack the guys who've been around forever and run the big committees because, you know, to take a shot and fail, you get, you know, massive payback on that one. So you can sort of see the tension that the sitting politicians and the parties face. I think at this point, the parties are suddenly becoming more concerned with this rise of outside influence of these PACs and these independent spending committees. I think you're absolutely right. Though you would think if that's the case, that at the end of the day, they could get the votes to fix that and to start bringing the money back into the party structure itself in order to regain some control over that. And so it'll be interesting to see whether there's a political solution to this, regardless of what the outcome of the case is.
Well, and I wonder, did anybody in the court raise this as an issue over the control, over who gets to control the agenda and the dialogue, the public dialogue?
Well, yes. I mean, Justice Scalia raised it quite overtly, with his view being that it would be better if the parties had the money. Why are you trying to weaken the parties? The parties are better entities. They're in the system, and they're sort of the only place where any decent compromise is going to get accomplished. And that these outside groups are what are sort of polarizing us. That was sort of the tenor of it, which, you know, Justice Scalia has long, I think, been a fan of the two-party system. If you go back to some of his other cases and some of Chief Justice Rehnquist's cases, for example, they sort of view preserving the two-party system as a valid goal of government, whereas I think it's a crazy goal. It's a wildly unconstitutional goal to decide that we're in power and we want to keep it that way. I'm a huge skeptic of that sort of approach, but you're absolutely right. The parties want to gain control and are finding some sympathy on parts of sort of the right wing of the court, which, while libertarian in some senses, are definitely sort of into the parties more.
Let me make a final call for questions quickly. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Okay. Well, Eric Jaffe, I don't see any further questions. I guess you've answered all the questions of our audience, so I certainly appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule this morning to attend the argument and then returning to report to our audience. This has been a very interesting discussion, and maybe we can have you back when the court's decision comes out, maybe even before the hue and cry begins. But I want to thank you for joining us today. And to our audience, I encourage you to join us tomorrow for our Teleforum conference call at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing an important Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals gun rights case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Dean. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.